I must confess that from time to time I find myself visiting in a congregation here or there or wherever it may be. And as I get there, the Bible class begins or the sermon begins by asking everyone to turn in their Bibles to James chapter 2 or John chapter 3 and verse 16 or 1 Corinthians chapter 13 or Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12, or one of these other very many familiar passages that we've all heard about a gazillion sermons on and countless classes on. And I find myself thinking, this again? We just studied this somewhere else. How many sermons are there that can be preached on this topic? Why can't we talk about something else for once, something different? And I must say, to my shame, when Tom and I were talking yesterday about who would be preaching this evening, whether it would be me or him, and it dawned on me that my class this morning in 1 Corinthians just happened to be on chapter 13, and my sermon this evening just happens to be on Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12. To my shame, my first thought was, these people are going to think that I'm another one of those preachers that just preaches about these common passages over and over and over. And how sad is that, that that's what my first thought was about myself, especially in the context of the golden rule in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Yet that is what I thought, sadly, and as I've come to think even this afternoon as I was looking over these again, how sadly mistaken I was, and how much these things do need to be talked about, and how just it is and how right it is that we come back to these topics over and over and over again. But let me assure you, just I guess to soothe my own ego, that I don't just preach on these things. It just is that that perfect storm that brought you here as we talk today about the great chapter on love in the morning and the great commandment to love our neighbor, although we may not say it that way. That's the gist of what Jesus is saying here in Matthew chapter 7. And perhaps this will help you as you take these words back to your own congregations, wherever they may be. And to our returning students, I know you've got to be thinking right now, seriously, is he still in the Sermon on the Mount? Has he not gotten any further than this over the entire summer? And I would remind you, we took about a two-month break to do our study on the elders, and various vacations and such have basically put us on a three-month break from this, and we're just now getting back to it. So that's why we haven't gotten any further than we have. Well, as Jesus is continuing his Sermon on the Mount, I guess an interesting development in my notes and the way I've looked at this over the years, the very first time I preached the Sermon on the Mount way, way, way back when, I had one sermon that talked about verses 1 through 12 of Matthew chapter 7. And as I retooled it to teach a class at the college a couple years ago on the Sermon on the Mount, I said, you know what, I better break that down. And I broke it down to verses 1 through 6 and then verses 7 through 12. And now here we have my third individual lesson on this same set of verses. If I keep preaching on this, I'm going to have 12 different sermons before I know it. But as Jesus gets to this point, what he says, and this is one of those places where probably more than anywhere else in the Sermon on the Mount, you scratch your head and you say, what on earth does this have to do with anything else? But notice how he begins. He begins by saying, therefore. There's your connector right there. It's not just, you know, something completely out of left field. He is talking about the same thing. Therefore, whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Now, this is, of course, one of the best known verses in the Bible. We talked just a few weeks ago about what is probably the best known verse in the Bible, which is not to judge people, because we like to use that as some kind of shield to protect ourselves from any harsh words. This is right up there as well. We call it the golden rule from time to time. We all know it very well, but sadly it's not one of the most practiced verses in the Bible. Even by those who do know it well, it's not practiced as often as it should be. One of the really interesting things you hear about this verse from skeptics, especially people who want to debunk Christianity, people who want to look at Jesus as just some other ordinary teacher, they look at this verse and they say, every religion teaches this. If you go through all the world religions and you listen to all of the different things that people have to say, you will find that every religion teaches this very thing. There's nothing unique about Christianity. There's nothing unique about Jesus' message. And the reality is that there are a lot of religions that say something very similar to this. However, what is invariably true among those religions is that they say the negative side of this. What those religions teach is, don't do to anyone what you don't want done to you. And that's a very noble principle. That's a very high-minded thing to think and to teach, and for those religions to advocate. But that is not at all the same thing as the positive form of this command, which is to do to others as you would have them do to you. And the positive form is far more searching than the negative form is. The positive form is far more demanding of us than the negative form is. For example, if you're just looking at the negative form of this that all of these other world religions teach, what they say basically is, if you don't want to be robbed, then don't rob someone else. If you don't enjoy being cursed, then don't curse other people. If you don't want to be clubbed over the head, then don't club someone else over the head. And it's very simple. If you don't like something, you don't do it. Very simple. Very, very high-minded, very noble, but very simple and very easy to apply. What Jesus calls us to, however, is a far higher standard, a far higher demand of us. What He says is, if you enjoy being loved, then go out and love other people. If you like to receive things, then go out and give to other people. If you like being appreciated, then go appreciate other people. And in the positive form, there is no way we can possibly withdraw into some kind of world where we think we can get by as long as we don't offend anybody. But we never accomplish any positive good either. No, what we see here is what we see consistently through the New Testament, and that is that Christianity demands community. We must be in relationship with one another. We must positively seek after the good of one another, even as we would have good done to us. And when you think through the New Testament, you find this kind of thing stated all over the place. You think about what the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 10, a verse we talked about this morning in the class, that in that command, as we typically think of it, to assemble with one another, the real command, the grammatical command, is in verse 24, and that is to consider one another. How to stir up love and good works. You think of the passage that Tom was reading from this morning in Matthew chapter 25 on that judgment scene where those people are rewarded or condemned based on the good they actively did for other people. For in doing so, they did that good to Christ Himself. You think of what Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 21 that we are to submit to one another. Christianity is all about community. It is all about doing good, positively doing good, not negatively doing bad. We must positively do good for one another. The negative correlation to this rule is known in all of these other religions, but that negative correlation, that version of this commandment, doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of what Jesus is teaching here in this verse to us. Well, again, Jesus begins by saying, therefore. And so we see that there is some kind of connection to what Jesus had been saying earlier. And we must understand it then in that context as well. And it's in this context of judgment. And really what is unfair judgment is kind of the picture that we've seen all through Matthew chapter 7 up to this point. First, there's the unfair judgment that people want to judge other people with, where you hold someone to a standard you don't want to be held to yourself. Or whether you are out actively trying to find fault in other people when you are completely ignoring the fault that is in your own life. But there is also a small picture, at least, of divine unfairness. Now we say, God's not unfair. God can't possibly be unfair. But the reality is, yes, He is. He is unfair to us to our benefit. God does not give us what we deserve. And thankfully so. God in His loving kindness, God in His long-suffering deals graciously with us. And we get just a hint of that in the verses we talked about last week, in asking and seeking and knocking and the good things that a father will give his child. And God gives these good things to those who ask. It is in that context that Jesus then says, therefore, go do good to others as you would have done to you. And so it begins really with this reminder of where we have been, this reminder of what God has done for us in spite of our sins, of God's attitude toward us and God's dealings with us. And only when we are aware of this, only when we are consciously thinking of the good that God has done for us in spite of ourselves, can the force of Jesus' statement really begin to hit home. And we're going to come back and talk about that in just a little while. But before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about what Jesus says itself, which is to deal with others by beginning with ourselves. We're not to determine our treatment of other people based on looking at them and asking ourselves what they deserve. Aside from the fact that we shouldn't be asking ourselves what they deserve anyway, what Jesus says is you treat people the way that you want to be treated. And the reason we don't deal with them by looking at them and asking what they deserve is, again, because that's not how God has dealt with us. And certainly we're not to deal with them and do good to them in order that they will do good to us. That's not what Jesus is saying here, obviously. Do good unto others so that they will do good unto you. Clearly, that's a terrible motivation as well. What we find here, again, is just this practical outgrowth of what it means to truly love your neighbor as you love yourself. You begin by looking at yourself, and you ask yourself, what is it that I like? What is it that I dislike? What is it that makes me happy? What is it that makes me sad? What is it that encourages me? What is it that discourages me? And you deal with your neighbor according to how you like to be treated. And again, it's not so that they will treat you that way. It's not that picture that again, Tom was talking about this morning in Philippians chapter 2, where we're always looking at the other person's side of things, but we are to truly seek out for their best. And not only do we do this in deeds, but also we are to do this in thought. And we are to do it in speech with respect to the whole of our life and all of our attitudes. It really reminds me of a scene in Abraham's life. It's a completely different concept, but I think there's a relation into how far we are to take this principle. In Abraham's life, as he was working one day, a few guys showed up. And Abraham fed them, and Sarah prepared a lot of food, and they are sitting there talking, and the angels who are there and God who is with them give the prediction that Sarah is going to have a child. And Sarah laughs to herself and refers in that context to Abraham as her Lord. Now, that's significant because that's the only time in the book of Genesis that Sarah refers to Abraham as Lord. So that must be what Peter was talking about when he referred to Sarah as this model of submission who called Abraham Lord. And the reason that is significant and what I want to point out this evening is because when Sarah said that, she is behind Abraham, she is in the tent, and she says it in the privacy of her own mind. Yet even at that deep of a level, even in that secret of a place, she has the utmost respect for her husband. And how powerful is that in showing how we ought to respect one another as well? And I think that principle is true here also. When is it that we do good for our neighbor? When is it that we seek their best as we would have done to us? Only when we interact with them? Only when we see them face to face? Or every time that we think about them, do we think the thoughts that we want thought of us? Do we talk about them the way that we would want people to talk about us? Even down to that most secret of a level, we are to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. What we are to do is we are to draw on our own self-interest. That's not something we typically think of as being a good thing in Christianity, but we are to draw on our own self-interest in order that we may understand how to treat others graciously. We must constantly be putting ourselves in their position, and in our conduct and in our behavior as it relates to them, we must do and not do, respectively, the things that we found pleasing and displeasing to ourselves. And the reality is, this is the solution to all of the world's problems, at least in terms of relationships. How simple is it? Whatever you wish others would do to you, do also to them. The sad reality, of course, is that we are far more inclined to draw on our own self-interest, not to learn how to treat others graciously, but we draw on our own self-interest so that we may serve ourselves. And that's what we must get past. But Jesus says this is absolutely vital. This is absolutely foundational. This is absolutely fundamental. In fact, this is at the heart of the law and the prophets. This is, Jesus says, the whole object, the whole purpose of everything that God has designed and everything that God has commanded. You find the same thing over in Matthew chapter 22, beginning in verse 36, where you have the familiar account of what is the greatest commandment. In Matthew chapter 22, beginning in verse 36, "Teacher," a lawyer says to him, "which is the great commandment in the law?" And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." And over in Romans chapter 13, a verse that Tom has alluded to the last couple of weeks in his sermons, Romans chapter 13, beginning in verse 9, we find this same thing said there. Romans 13, verse 9, "The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Everything depends on this. He goes on to say, love is the fulfilling of the law. The reality is that God's message has not changed over the years. What God commanded to them in the Old Testament is exactly what He commands to us today, at least in principle. Some of the specifics of the covenant may have changed, but what God demands of His people has not changed. And sometimes I think we draw too stark of a line between the Old and the New Testaments, as if God Himself has somehow changed and He wants something different of humanity than He used to want. Well, God doesn't want sacrifices anymore. That's the old law. Oh, yes, God does want sacrifices. You better believe He does. Yourself, your body as a living sacrifice. Christ the sacrifice for our sins. There are some specifics that are different, but what God wants and who God is has not changed. Unfortunately, some of that comes from a misconception of this very sermon. In Matthew chapter 5, you find Jesus going through this long series of "you have heard that it was said, but I say to you" statements. And we read that, and very often we see that as Jesus coming along and trying to undo the Old Testament, and He is replacing that with the New Testament and the new law. And for all of the reasons we talked about when we considered that section of the Sermon on the Mount, it's best to understand that not as Jesus undoing the law, not as Jesus changing the law, but as Jesus correcting the Pharisaic perversions of the law so that the people would know what God wants and what God has always wanted of His people. One of the interesting things that you'll find as you look through that chapter and through that section is all of the things that Jesus demands in the new law, if you look at it that way, are things that Jesus had already, or that God had already commanded in the old law as well. He's correcting the Pharisaic perversions of it. It's what God has always wanted. And the same thing is true here. What God wanted then when He told them way back when to love your neighbor as yourself is exactly what God wants now. Love your neighbor as yourself. Treat them actively as you would like to be treated. And sometimes we also get this misconception of the old law as if it's just a bunch of rules to keep. We may even look at the New Testament that way as well sometimes. That it's something that we observe mechanically or detached or almost impersonally from time to time. That we regard it almost as a series of regulations that have been issued from some kind of machine. And our job is to read the rules and follow the instructions, and that is all that we are to do. Now, we may never come right out and say that, but I'm afraid sometimes we act like that's what God expects. This long list of rules, we follow the rules, we do everything right, and then everything is going to be just fine. And we think of the law as a thing in and of itself, that, you know, we just keep these regulations, we never deviate, all will be well. And in the process of that, of course, we forget the spirit of the law. We forget the relationship that God is calling us to, a relationship that He is calling us to with Himself and with our fellow man as well. And ultimately, what Jesus says here, what Jesus says in Matthew 22, what Paul says in Romans 13, what God has said throughout the entire Old Testament, is that love is what stands behind the law. Why is it that God commanded that we don't covet and that we don't kill and that we don't steal? Is it because God knew we needed some rules to follow? And so He thought, here are some pretty good rules. That sounds like a good idea. Don't covet, don't kill. Those are good. Here are your rules to follow. Now you have some rules, and that'll keep you occupied for a while you're here on the earth. Is that what it's about, just to give us some rules? Obviously not. It's the Spirit that stands behind the rules. The reason the rules come out, the reason the laws are there, is because of the principle that stands behind them. And that principle is to love your neighbor as yourself. Sadly, we need the rules because, well, it makes me think of my son, and I'm sure anyone else with children would say the same thing. You just give them the principle and they're not going to know what on earth to do with it. I mean, I can't tell you how many times a day I find myself saying, "Silas, be careful. Silas, be careful. Silas, be careful." And he has no concept of what that means by itself. And so then I always will have to say, "Silas, don't stand on that chair. Silas, don't stand on top of the slide. Silas, don't stand on the back of the couch. Silas, don't stand on a tight rope over a crocodile-infested pit of molten lava," or whatever else it may be. You know, be careful. And if I just say that, it doesn't mean anything to him. And so the rules have to follow as well. And the same thing is true of us. The problem, however, is when the rules come, we focus on the rules. And we think about the rules, and we want to keep the rules, and we want to obey the laws, and we want to do all the things that God has told us to do. And that is all very well, and that is all very good, and we need to focus on those things and do those things, but we must not get hung up on the details of the law to the neglect of the principle. That we think what it's all about is not killing, and not coveting, and not stealing, and that's what God really wants. No, what God really wants is us to love. And those things will take care of themselves. What is vital in Christianity is not that we not steal or kill or covet. Those things are important, obviously. But that's not what's vital to Christianity. What is vital to Christianity is that you do love. That you understand your neighbor. You desire the well-being of your neighbor even as you desire your own. And those other things will fall right into line. And that's why love is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. You know, people hear this message of Jesus and people praise this message of Jesus. It is a highly praised message that Jesus teaches here. It's heard, it's lauded by people all over the world, whether they respect Jesus or not. However, this is a message that, of course, is not meant to be praised, but to be practiced. Not merely to be commented on, but to be carried out. And again, the people who are in the world that praise it very rarely do it. And sadly, very many people who are in the church find it a difficult job to do as well. And in fact, Jesus will speak directly to this problem of people who hear it and praise it, but don't practice it. As he ends this sermon, he will say in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 24, "Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on a rock. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell, and great was its fall." It's the same thing that James will say also in James chapter 1, as he deals with this exact kind of problem. James chapter 1, beginning in verse 22, "But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror. For he looks at himself and goes away and at once forgets what he was like. But the one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, he will be blessed in his doing." Jesus calls us not to just hear this message, not just to lift it up and praise it, but to do the things that He commands. So why is it that we don't do any better than we do? Why is it that the world at large, and sometimes Christians in particular, fail to follow a message that is so profound and so world-changing as this? Well, most people in the world, of course, live lives based on selfishness and self-centeredness. And as Christians, that's something we simply must not do. we must do everything we can not to live a life of selfishness and self-centeredness. And you know, we talked this morning about the church in Corinth and all the problems they had and all the obstacles they faced with their self-centeredness and their failure to understand what it meant to follow a crucified Christ and the way they were constantly putting themselves first. And we shake our heads at them. We read Corinthians and we study Corinthians and we say, how could they have been so foolish as to always be thinking of themselves and their egotistical attitudes? And then we turn around and we get hung up on our preferences at the assembly. And that song leader and the songs he sang or the tune he sung them to or the pitch that he started at or how fast or how slow it was and that preacher and how long he preached and that topic he preached about. Everyone's always preaching about the golden rule, I tell you what. And that person who was leading the prayer and how long he went or how many cliches he used or how preachy he was in that prayer or whatever else the case may be, we're constantly thinking of ourselves. I hope we're not. But it's very easy to fall into that kind of trap. It's very easy to think about our precious time and how little of it we have and how other people are wasting it. Or our right of way and that person who just cut me off. Or whatever else the case may be. We have no problem whatsoever with the loving yourself part of the command to love your neighbor as you love yourself. That's the easy part. The problem is the fact that it's so easy to love yourself in the wrong way. And it's so difficult to transfer our thought away from ourselves into the other person that we're supposed to be loving to begin with. And the sad reality is that our failure to keep this command, when we fail to keep it, is due to the fact that we're too often self-centered. Which leads to self-satisfaction and self-protection and self-concern. And the reality is that all disputes and all quarreling and all unhappiness and failed relationships, whether it's between individuals or social groups or nations, all disputes come down to self-centeredness. And if we truly loved each other as we loved ourselves, if we truly did for others as we would have done to ourselves, those things would go away. And far too often, we let ourselves get caught up in this as well. Well, how is it that we do better than we do? What do we need in order to really follow this command as we ought to follow it? And I would say it begins on the most fundamental level of all. And that is, we must start with God. And this is what I said at the beginning that we would come back to later. The great command, Jesus says in Matthew chapter 22, is to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind. Now here in Matthew 7 and over in Romans chapter 13 as well, the emphasis by Jesus and Paul respectively is on loving your neighbor. And that's the emphasis that Tom has been making the last couple of weeks as well. And rightfully so, because there is a place to make that emphasis. And it is a right relationship with our fellow man that is evidence of a right relationship with God. Obviously, it's not a replacement of a right relationship with God, but it is evidence of that. Because you won't truly love your fellow man the way you're supposed to unless you love God the way you are supposed to. But again, that points us back to what the beginning point is, which is loving God the way you're supposed to. And I don't want to at all take away from the emphasis that Tom's been making in his sermons, because if Jesus can make that emphasis and Paul can make that emphasis, then certainly there's a place for it. However, I want to make the other emphasis this evening, and that is it begins with God. And our fascination with ourself can only end when we've become fascinated with God instead. Our relationships in the world cannot be right unless we begin with God. It is impossible to properly love your neighbor and do good for them the way you are called to until you first love God. You will never be able to see yourself or your neighbor aright until you have seen both in the sight of God. We have been made by God, we have been made for God, and we can function truly only when we are in relationship with God. And it is when an absolute love for God has driven out of us an absolute love for self, then we will be able to be free to love others as we ought. And until that happens, until we can truly say, as we often sing, none of self and all of thee, until that happens, our self-love will always prevent us from being able to look at the interests of others in the same way that we look at our own interests. Only God can deliver us from ourselves. Only God can enable us to love others selflessly. And when we start with God, when we look at ourselves through the lens of the Bible, when we look at ourselves the way that God looks at us, ultimately what we see is that we are sinners, that we are lost, that we are condemned, that we have no rights before God, that we are people of unclean lips. We are a group of worthless creatures in the sight of God. But again, God does not deal with us as we deserve. God has dealt graciously with us instead. And so what Jesus says in the verses leading up to this, again, is, which one of you, if a son asks him for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a serpent? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask Him? He has given us good things in spite of our being what we are. And this is how God deals with us. Therefore, Jesus says, you deal like that with your fellow man. Look at them as Christ has looked at you. And when we are able to do that, then we will be freed from the tyranny of self. Then we will be able to live the standard to which we are called, to do unto others as we would have done to us. In Luke chapter 10, Jesus is asked by a lawyer, what is it that he needs to do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus answers by saying, well, what is the law? And he says what Jesus says in Matthew 22, are the two great commands. Love God and love your neighbor. And Jesus says, you're right. And so the lawyer says, well, who is my neighbor? And Jesus tells what is the very familiar parable to us of the Good Samaritan. There was a traveler who was traveling. He was attacked by robbers. He was left for dead. He was passed by a couple of religious folks who didn't want to have anything to do with him. And finally, a Samaritan came along and helped him and gave of himself and provided for this person until he was well again. And then Jesus says, who proved to be his neighbor? Sometimes when we look at this story, we say the conclusion, the point of this, is that whoever needs our help is our neighbor. But notice the reversal that Jesus makes here. When Jesus asks the question back to the lawyer, he doesn't ask it the same way the lawyer asked him. The lawyer says, who is my neighbor? In the lawyer's mind, that the neighbor was somebody else. Really, what his question, he's seeking to justify himself, what his question is how many people are there out there who I am compelled to love? Draw a nice little circle around it, and of course in the mind of the rabbis of that day, Jews is as far as that circle would go. Draw a nice little circle around it, tell me who my neighbors are so I can love those people and I can be done with the whole thing. Who is my neighbor? But what Jesus answers, or what Jesus asks back, is not who the neighbor was, but who was the neighbor. Who is it, Jesus said, that acted like a neighbor in this scene? The answer isn't the injured man is the neighbor you need to take care of. The answer is the Samaritan was the neighbor who did good to someone else. The lawyer had asked about who his neighbor was as if he was the passive object of someone else's action. That neighbor is that person out there that needs something or that I need to love. And what Jesus teaches is that the neighbor is the active doer of the action. At least as far as I am concerned, the neighbor needs to be me. That's what Jesus is saying here. Our neighbor isn't whoever happens to be in need. So that, you know, we better keep our eyes open out there because there may be a neighbor out there that we're looking for. According to this story, we are to be the neighbors of other people. this great parable that Jesus tells us shows us that the proper question isn't who our neighbor is, but who we can be neighbors to. And the same thing applies in Matthew chapter 7. As we began by saying that this golden rule, as it is called, is the positive form of what so many religions express negatively. And that is, we are to go out and we are to seek the good of other people. We are to be the neighbors to other people. And in so doing, love all man as we love ourselves. This is the foundation on which all of God's message of all time is built. Everything that God has ever said to mankind, everything that God has ever taught, everything that God has ever expected is built on this foundation. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. And how small do I feel right now? I didn't want to teach this sermon on something that everyone's heard a million times. Oh, it's not that important. It's just the foundation of everything that we are called to do. As we saw in 1 Corinthians 13 this morning, what we are called to there is to be love even as God is love. There is good reason these texts are we come back to these texts over and over again. They are vital to us as Christians. They are foundational to us as Christians. They are everything that we are called to be and everything that we are called to do. Take your songbook, if you would, and turn to number 356. We'll sing that in just a moment as a song of encouragement to anyone here who needs encouragement. There are a variety of situations of life that we may all find ourselves in. And the reality is we all need encouragement of some kind, I'm sure. But there are people here this evening who may need help in a special kind of way. Whether you want to give your life to Christ, whether you want to make something in your life right, whether you are just seeking the encouragement, the edification of the saints in a special way. If there's any way that we can help you this evening, won't you come while we stand and sing?